Hi all, this is Yogendra Purani, popularly known as Yogi, from Japan. And I am known as the first Asian origin politician, elected politician in Japan. I also now work in the administrative services of Japanese government. And now you are listening to Trust Me, I Know What I Am Doing.
Yeah. My name is Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with talented and interesting individuals linked to the global Indian and South Asian community. It's informal and informative, adding insights to our evolving cultural expressions, where each person can proudly say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. Hi, everyone. On this episode of Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing, we share a conversation with bureaucrat, educator, and Japanese politician, Yogi Puranik. Stay tuned. Whether it's your first time listening to an episode or it's first up on your weekly playlist, thank you so much for listening, and I'm certainly quite grateful. I truly appreciate you sharing it with your friends and your family, for rating and kindly reviewing it, and of course for following along on social media. So we've talked a lot about life in the diaspora and perspectives on endeavors within India or South Asia, and the more typical tethers, of course, into the US, Canada, and the UK. We've certainly also had some glimpses from other common areas on this show, like Africa, Australia, the Middle East, and Fiji. What about the less obvious places where we know we're having impact, especially in cultures where integration can be challenging or even relatively new? So recently I caught up with Yogendra Puranik, a bureaucrat, politician, and educator in Japan. He is belovedly known as Yogi-san. And after growing up and going to university in Maharashtra and completing international business management training at IIM in Calcutta, he's been living for almost 25 years in Japan, where his journey has been filled with some notable milestones. After significant success in the IT and banking sectors, Yogi is the first person of Indian origin to win a Japanese election, serving on one of Tokyo's city councils. He's been a longtime cultural ambassador in Nishi Kasai, a Japanese town known for its large Indian population, and has opened two restaurants in Edagawa, which also serve to host concerts and classes and a range of Indian cultural offerings. Now, he's turned his attention to education, serving as the first ever foreign origin principal of a public government school and the first ever Indian origin civil gazetted officer in Japan. I had a chance to share some time with Yogi-san, and of course, by the way, also with his chirping birds in the background. We chatted about his remarkable experiences and the many sparkles and realities of his journey, and in the end, how he cultivates trust in his unique environment. But even after nearly 25 years, I was actually first curious to know whether Yogi-san was feeling like he was still adjusting to life in Japan.
Yeah. I think so. In fact, like, I've been here for 25 years and I'm still adjusting. There is so much to know about this country. In fact, this country has a whole lot of hidden secrets from the cultural perspective.
Yeah.
There are people here in Japan who are here for like four generations, five generations, more generations now. And still they find themselves, like, they find difficult to know about this nation in whole. So it's I'm not sure what is it, but Japan is truly different from all other countries in the world.
Yeah.
They do things which are not said or not heard, but they just keep on doing those things.
You know, as the time has gone on, has that adjustment gotten easier, or is it just that you keep finding new things about Japanese culture and life that you are surprised by?
I do keep finding new things, and one thing is about the day-to-day life and, say, the language, the culture part in the day-to-day life. And apart from that, when we look into the operational part of life here, like, suppose, say, the visa policies or the way the police approach towards us.
Yeah.
I many a times feel like things were better 20 years back than now. And some things have traversed toward positivity, but some things have actually travels towards negativity.
Yeah, regress.
I do feel that. And those things which have gone to the negative side, they pose new challenges.
Yeah.
And that's why we have to keep adjusting.
And for those things that are new challenges that have perhaps regressed in Japanese society, particularly from the Indian or the foreign or the immigrant perspective. For you, do you find it that much easier because you've been there longer as opposed to those who are facing this brand new because they're new immigrants to Japan? And by the way, is it important for you to in fact find community and coalition with some of these newer immigrants as well?
In fact, before new and old, the single largest barrier of living in a language-oriented country is the language itself.
Yeah.
And if I have to talk in terms of a thumb rule, it's the 80-20 management principle that works, that 20% people are fairly linguist, and the rest 80% actually they are not so good linguist. They don't understand Japanese so well.
So, right.
And most of the information that is available in Japan is still in Japanese only. Okay. After the corona pandemic, the government is now strongly moving towards a multilingual regime in terms of providing multilingual websites. In fact, the auto-translated websites. So language is actually a very high barrier. And the amount of literature about Japan that is available on the internet is not so much. It's very limited. Even for a newcomer or even for an oldcomer like me coming to Japan, there is no recipe book on the internet or anywhere else which can teach us about what Japan is, what Japanese people like, what they don't like, what are the do's and don'ts in Japan. These things are not collated anywhere. And hence, for anybody, including me, who has been living here for 25 years, I think Japan is still every day. It's a kind of what you can say. It's a new journey every time.
Yeah.
And for a person like me who has tried going into multiple what you can say industries, including politics, and now into the government, it's really a very high learning curve every day.
Right. Yeah. You know, and I can imagine that, you know, that learning and unlearning and relearning happens, you know, quite a bit. In a way, over your 25 years in building relationships and certainly being someone who has successfully penetrated some of those cultural barriers and linguistic barriers and even structural barriers, you've represented in a way kind of a wonderful sanctuary for Indian culture and those around you in the community. As you continue to integrate yourself, does the sense of responsibility to do that, does that also evolve over time, even when you're faced with accelerators and even barriers?
Yeah, and that fairly is because I have seen Japanese, they have their pre-decided norms. They live with assumptions. And hence, the barrier for the immigrant community is very high. So, they will have a typical definition for the Indians. They will have a typical definition for the Indian food. They will have a typical definition for the Americans. And they don't try to redefine over time. Those definitions actually just stay like that. And that causes a problem in terms of, say, diversity, or on the reverse side, the inclusion. And hence, maybe I was lucky that I have broken a few barriers in this country, being the first elect from not just from Asia, but I was the only fifth person of non-Japanese origin to be elected through Japanese elections. And now I work as an administrative civil services officer, and I have become a principal of a Japanese school that is also for the first time in Japan's history. And I am now also working as a CIO for one of the state governments. So these are all first time. And if you saw last week, I uploaded on my SNS, I was appointed as a deputy superintendent of police for a day. And that's also first time for a foreigner to do in Japan. So, you know, I call this as breaking the barriers and creating an image in the minds of the Japanese people that, yes, foreigners can be given these opportunities, and they can, if given a right opportunities, these people will integrate into the society.
You know, with each of these firsts, right, each of these barriers that are broken, do you even feel more responsibility with each one that you take on, that it's almost like it's an additive set of principles?
Yes, all the time. Because if I fail as a politician, normally the Japanese person will think about voting for the next non-Japanese politician. If I fail as an administrative officer next time, in fact, even today, like many people, they try to actually find out my small mistakes and they complain to the government, like, have you selected a right person? Is he the right person? So
it's a microscopic level of scrutiny. Yeah,
they do. And really small things they find out. There is also fake news, like they write articles which are not even true. So coming back to the responsibility thing, the responsibility is very high because since we are breaking the barriers, if we don't break the barriers correctly and sufficiently, these barriers will further become high because next time they will have a very much more difficult scrutiny.
You mentioned some of these firsts, but you were the first Asian and certainly the first Indian member of the Legislative Assembly that's been elected, and which obviously requires a true leap of faith when it comes to even running for office. And I'm curious, you know, not just when campaigning, but even when governing, what did you actually discover about yourself?
My realization was, honestly, I need to grow. That was the first thing. Mm. And when I started doing things at the real level, I started feeling at a loss of philosophy. Particularly when I stepped into politics and when I started writing my mandate, I was like, what is it people are wanting? Right. What do they really want? And the biggest problem there is the kind of philosophy that we have in India. Mm. While the similar philosophy traveled to Japan, particularly after the Second World War, in fact, from the Meiji Revolution in Japan, Japan has actually kept that philosophical part aside and they are more operational. So if I go and I speak, like, I use words like bliss or happiness, nobody buys it. And like, say, if in the education I talk about some universal education, people actually call me as non-scientific. Yoga.
Yeah.
Connecting to the universe. People actually call me non-scientific. These are no more non-scientific things. Now, many universities in the US, they hold programs on chakras and yoga and so many things. And they offer degrees.
Sure.
But this part of the world considers those things to be highly non-scientific. So from that perspective, I actually have to reshape and redesign my thinking on and try to understand these people more, why they are like this. Then I have to work on what to do. In fact, 2 years in the politics, and then I was really at the lack of my philosophy, because the assembly is all operational. If you see the Indian assembly, there will be poems, there will be jargons, there will be interesting metaphors that people will be talking about. But if you see the Japanese assembly, this all is absolutely not allowed. They will be just operational. For them, the philosophy is like talking about SDGs. But SDGs is not a philosophy. It's again an operational thing. And that really created a huge problem for me. And then I decided to go on a pilgrimage. And I spent later, fortunately, the Indian government actually invited me. And I spent 45 days in India refinding myself.
And even with that, I mean, I'm imagining that, as you said, this was something you had to, in some ways, rediscover yourself or rediscover your philosophy. And I'm also imagining that this must have been a relative surprise. Even with that, did you find yourself actually reaffirming some of your own core values, though? Even though this was, of course, a different environment that you were in, did it strengthen, in a way, some of those values?
Yeah, it did. It did. Because like now, being in education for the last 2 years, I look at my students and I look at the overall education domain here. And what I find is so many students are philosophically broken, rather psychologically broken. Like even in my school, I have 10% of students who actually normally don't come to the school so often. And I have started reaffirming that the kind of philosophy that we learned in India, and being accommodative, being compassionate, being inclusive, the lack of those fundamentals in the society. I have seen like Japanese people are very strict to each other. There is a kind of followership. I am following these rules. You have to follow these rules. And if you're not following those rules, you are not a part of my group. So that kind of mentality or that kind of thought process is actually breaking a lot of people in schools, at workplaces. And hence, I have started reaffirming that the kind of philosophy I carried from India actually holds true. That I'm really reaffirming.
Well, and it sounds like it's a direct contrast with some of the rigidity is in place structurally. You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, we'll come back to our conversation with bureaucrat, educator, and Japanese politician, Yogi Puranik. Stay tuned. Conversation. It's the antidote to apathy and the catalyst for relationships. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Krish Ashok, author of Masala Lab, The Science of Indian Cooking, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hi, this is Farhan Akhtar.
Hi, guys. I'm Ananya Pandey.
Hi, this is Madhuri Dixit, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing with Abhay Dandekar.
Welcome back to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with Yogi Puranik. You know, I want to come back to one of the things, even that, again, is speaking to that rigidity. In both India and the U.S. now, this year, there are elections coming up.
Even in Japan, same time.
Even in Japan, okay. So, you know, from your experiences, what's perhaps, and I think I've heard you speak about this before, but what's perhaps so, like one or two things that are just so strikingly different about elections in Japan compared to those elections perhaps in India and the U.S.? I know that the rules and the policies and the operations are just incredibly, you know, both philosophically and just systemically so different.
True. In fact, from that perspective, like in 2020, I was elected from the Japan side. Every year, there is a politician exchange program between the US and the Japanese politicians. And 9 to 10 politicians are selected from both the sides. And we do an exchange program. So I participated in the US-Japan political exchange program in 2020. We had discussions with the White House and lobbyists and many, many people, and it helped me actually understand the US politics as well. The way I find it different is, first of all, in India, actually, politics is a kind of, I said it before also, politics is a religion and politicians are God. And making that politician a godlike figure is kind of a natural phenomenon in India. And that's, in some terms, I find that it is creating new challenges for India in terms of transparency and some other facets. But as I said, like, if you see the assembly, it's so lively. Those are some interesting aspects of Japanese politics. And another thing is, like, in India, if you have to win an election, you have to have certain backing, then you have to have that big team and loads of funding, self-funding, and loads
big of political operation,
infrastructure, trucks and cars, and so much. Right. If you see Japan, Japan is more systematic about it. Like, say, in Japan, when I'm campaigning, I'm not allowed to actually run two cars together, just one car.
Right.
And in the campaign car, only 4 people can sit. If you see India, like in the campaign truck, there will be 400 people. So,
and I believe each candidate also gets the exact same amount of funding.
Funding, yes.
From the government.
Yes, yes. Exact same amount of funding, and which is quite enough. So you don't need really to shed out of your pocket. Well, how I see it is like Japanese elections actually give equal opportunity even to a newcomer if you do hard work. Like I also ran my first election and I won it. It is only because I think the elections here give you an equal opportunity.
Right. There's actually a fair chance.
During my US-Japan political exchange, I realized like the politicians on US side, they were actually of the opinion like US gives very low opportunity to the newcomers. And the newcomers either have to go under the Republican belt or the Democrats belt to win an election.
Yeah.
And if you are not going under these two, then basically it's very difficult for you to win an election.
Right. So, which is very much the case, especially in the US for, you know, new Indians or South Asians who are in fact running for elected office, that this is of course a huge challenge as well. That, you know, idea of having a civic exercise, right? Like you were able to navigate through that. And you've worked now for so many years in tech and in the banking system, in politics, now in service in the education sector and in a government role. These all likely, as you've mentioned, right, they require rapid learning and unlearning to become comfortable. Have you noticed that as you go from each of these places, right, each of these spaces, has there been a common thread to all of these experiences that have, you know, in a way, link them all together?
Yes, and particularly in terms of Japan, I find the positive thread and the negative thread. The positive thread is that all Japanese tend to actually manage their operations in a similar way. They all will manage their diaries, they will all manage their times, and they will be particular about their documentation, similar kind of documentation. It's very interesting to understand. In fact, I don't have an answer to research on why the whole nation comes out as the same breed. Like, say, if you see in US, if you see in India, there will be differences in people, the way they document things, the way they describe things, the way they respond to you. But if you come to Japan, it's the whole same breed. If you ask them for the way, everybody will tell you it the same way. If you commit a time with them, they will immediately take out their diary and they will write. So there will be no Japanese person who will actually try to remember your meeting time here, which we normally tend to. Even today and even if it is after 2 hours, the Japanese person will write it in a diary. And that's one side. Like whichever industry you go, their working styles and operating styles are quite close by. The negative side out of it is I'm seeing like Japanese people they keep themselves to their own, what you can say, a limited.
It's very insular.
Yeah. So like they won't take responsibility of anything which is outside their bounds or outside their responsibility circle. And that poses a real problem because many a times people will say, I don't know. I'm not eligible to answer this. So and that silo making is very rigid in Japan, and it is so much siloed that many a times there is no one who is actually looking after the whole cycle. And this also is quite often seen in the democracy. And what I find is even in assemblies or even the government offices, if you have a social problem, normally the officers, they are not trying to solve the social problem, but they are trying to solve one person's problem or they are trying to give a point solution. And that's creating a real huge problem for Japan, I believe. Because
of course,
the problems are piling up. Social problems are piling up. So suppose in Corona times, we had social problems. Social problems for the immigrant community, social problems for the restaurant community, social problems for the liquor community. And what I found is there was nobody in the government who was ready to look after the whole chain of events. They were like, okay, you have problem? Okay, I'll solve this. Oh, you have a problem? I'll solve this kind of. So, there is so much of delay in that problem solving. Still, I think Japan was far better than other countries in problem handling. But I am finding that the democratic system is not really working great. Be it India, be it Japan. Mm. So nobody is taking that final responsibility. And in the assemblies, it is finally the majority which wins, but it's not the logicalness or real solution solving that works in the assembly. In assembly, I used to say, like, if this is the way we are working, then we need to rethink democracy. We really need to rethink democracy. And that democratic behavior actually is happening everywhere. Like, say now I'm a school principal, and in my school, decisions are made democratically. So whenever we are making decisions, we normally pile up things. In once a month, we will have all our teachers and officers in the same room, and then we will say, okay, we want to make this change, and then what is your opinion? And democratically, we are deciding on the strategy of the school. And I think it's pathetic. I think it's pathetic because 80% of teachers, they are not interested in those kind of things. They are actually deeply into their day-to-day things. They don't know strategy. They don't know where Japan is heading to. They don't know where the globe is heading to. And still, they are pulled into the system to decide things democratically.
One thing I want to ask, and that is that you have now been there for, you know, so long, and you're a Japanese citizen, and yet, is it very hard to consider yourself as part of the we, or is it still kind of a they do this and I do this? You know, sometimes that can be a challenge. And yet at some point, there does have to be a sense of we to this.
Very interesting question, because when I was elected, I was trying to understand who voted for me.
Yeah.
And probably that who would answer your question. And my analysis was that those people who were not going to polling booths, they voted for me. And they considered me as a part of their we, because they were not considering the other Japanese politicians as a part of their we.
They've got it.
Yeah. So these people trusted me because they thought, like, okay, I'm educated. I'm thinking logically the same way they are thinking. And that's why they voted for
right.
me. Similarly, in my school, there will be, or even in my government job, there are people who actually trust me that I will bring up a change.
Right.
And then there are other set of people who say, like, who wants change? We don't want change. Mm. So you are not a part of we. That is quite, what you can say, visible, even in the behaviors of the people. So, and particularly when it comes to Japan, there is a big lot. Which is actually conservative, highly conservative, and it's very difficult to be a part of their we.
I read that you've personally experienced and witnessed some bullying in the corporate world, and certainly even in the educational system, even what I've read, even with your own son. And do you think this is not an easy question to answer, perhaps, but do you think this is just purely cultural friction that hopefully gets better over time and with familiarity? Or in fact, as you mentioned, is it a lot of structural, you know, rigidity, or for that matter, even just, you know, xenophobia or even racism for that matter?
See, there are multiple facets to this question. See, one thing is, like, the bullying or the discrimination happens even between the Japanese. And then it happens between the Japanese and the non-Japanese. And it happens at different levels. Then it also happens largely between the genders. In Japan, women are highly discriminatory. Be it educational opportunities, be it work opportunities. Like, say, recently, 2 years back, there was a big scandal which came out, like, the medical universities of Japan, they would purposely give less marks to same answers by the women candidates, and they would reduce their numbers and not get them into the medical universities. And it was a scandal that was going on for years. And I'll give you one funny example. Like, last year in my school, one media company, they contacted my school and they said, like, they want to bring one very famous young hero to my school. And they wanted to do a program. So my other staff, few of my staff, they rejected the idea. I said, the guy is coming and, you know, it's going to be such a PR for us. And they said, no, no. So, but initially they won't say what the reason behind it. They said, no, we don't want to be like our students will get disturbed. But then finally, one of the teachers spoke out. He said, Yogi sir, you know, this hero, he's very popular with young girls. So if we get him to our school, boys will stop coming to our school. We will give out the signal that we are promoting education for girls. So I said, even if so, what is the problem? And then he said, you know, normally boys go to science streams and girls go to the art streams. And we want to focus, we want that our focus should actually, our school should focus on the science stream. And we should be sending out more students to the science stream. So it was a shock for me. These guys are still living in that mental era.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, we'll come back to our conversation with bureaucrat, educator, and Japanese politician, Yogi Puranik. Stay tuned. Every story told is a lesson learned, and every lesson learned is a story waiting to be told. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So hi, I'm Anand Deshpande. I'm the founder of Persistent Systems Limited. And you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hey, this is Nimesh Patel.
Hey, this is Cal Penn.
Hi, my name is Richa Morjani, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing with Abhay Dandekar.
Hi there, I'm Abhay Dandekar, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with Yogi Puranik.
Well, and so for you, does that is that same rigidity, is it translating particularly also to that cultural aspect as well, especially when it comes to being ethnically or culturally Indian in a Japanese society?
It's both ways. One is definitely the Japanese look down upon the Asians very openly. Yeah. Very openly, they will actually look up to the Westerners and they look down on the Asians. But given that, like say when I won the election, actually there were many, many non-Japanese people from different nationalities. They contacted me, Yogi-san, how did you do that? And we also want to do it. And then honestly, I was of the frank opinion, like I could win because I was Indian. And there will be many other nationalities, even if they are good, it will be very difficult for them to win. Because as I say, like the Japanese wear their own specs. They have their own definitions of this nationality or this nationality. Oh, Indians are, maybe they are, Indians are intelligent, at least to some extent.
Yeah.
So winning in the election was maybe easier because I was Indian, but also difficult because I was an Asian. So that truth lies there. And another thing I'll tell you, like, while I am breaking the barriers in quite difficult areas, like politics and administrative services, it's actually very, what you can say, very sad to see that even in international outfits like, say, Amazon or Google, I hear about many cases like there the Japanese bosses, they harass the non-Japanese people working there, and particularly the Indians. Now, there could be also, the reason could be the difference in working styles, but I don't think that the reason is limited to that. The reason is also about the discrimination.
Do you worry about what kind of barriers and eventual, you know, environment this may offer for your son?
So actually on one of the TV interviews in Japan, they asked me a question. Yogi-san, let's say like you will work as a politician for next 20 years. What do you think the kind of change you will bring to Japan? I said, honestly, nothing. Only change that I could bring is there'll be more non-Japanese people who will try to enter politics. And when they try to enter politics, as more people join, more non-Japanese people join politics, they will actually convey their ideas to people and the SMEs. So
yeah,
hopefully in the next 20 years, if I continue to be a politician, only that change is something maybe I'll bring to this country. Otherwise, it's very tough. It's very tough. Now, in my administrative services, I'm trying not to define the big change. I'm keeping that big change in my mind. And I'm trying to show operational changes. I'm trying to make operational changes, which actually won't define the directional change. So people don't know what's the big picture. That is how I have to work.
It's almost disguised, right? Well, and in a way, is it then inevitable that there's always a plateau for culturally, for foreign nationals, for immigrants, for those who are culturally different in Japanese society? You know, so for someone like your son in the future, is there always going to be a ceiling to, you know, actually like achieve or thrive successfully? Or does it just simply require that many more non-Japanese people to be in positions of power or positions in politics or positions in the government to help bend that? Do you feel like there's too low of a ceiling, or is there promise and maybe opportunity there?
I think for next few generations, it will be still the same struggle. The level of acceptance might increase a bit because, like, say, my son went to the Japanese school here, so he has some Japanese friends from his childhood. Like, right now, my son is in the UK. Whenever he comes back to Japan, these friends meet, they go together somewhere enjoying, they go to Disneyland kind of. So at least in smaller circles, maybe he will have some acceptance. But tomorrow, if he has to try things in a bigger circle, say politics or say administrative services, I think the barrier will be again similarly high. So, in fact, in one of the television interviews, my son was asked, would you like to, after you graduate from the university, would you like to work in Japan or in the UK or in some other world? So he said, in UK, he has found he has a lot of freedom. He has a freedom of thought. He has a freedom of actions, which he doesn't find in Japan. Japan is a set of rules, and you have to be in those rules. He finds it difficult to be in those rules. So, but let's see how his way of looking at things, how his dimensions change over time. 12 years back, when I thought of taking Japanese nationality. I was confused whether that's the right decision or not. And then I spent a couple of weeks in France where I was doing my PhD in the past. And then I went to US for a couple of weeks in Washington, a couple of weeks in New York, back a couple of weeks in Singapore. And while I reached Singapore, I had decided that Japan is good for me. So as he sees more horizons, I think maybe he will try to choose the right place for himself.
But for you, it still remains the choice that you're still proud of.
Yeah, Japan is quite the in fact, the first home for me today. Means maybe the Indians may not like it, but I spent 19 years in India, 25 years in Japan. And ultimately, wherever you go, there will be positive aspects, there will be negative aspects. And after living in Japan for 25 years, for day-to-day life, now Japan, I find Japan is more suited to me. Maybe I have adopted myself to this land. But at the same time, as we have been talking throughout this conversation, is the Indian philosophy is the bigger part of my heart and my soul. So that won't be lost anytime. So I'll still continue to live in Japan for years to come, but that Indian philosophical part will not be lost. It will be still there. From that perspective, I find my son in a problem because he is unable to define himself, whether he's an Indian, whether he's a Japanese, and now whether he's more towards UK. He doesn't know that. I find that problem in his conversations. So what this brings to me another problem is, in fact, these days, when I go to India, I actually go to universities and train students about how they need to prepare for immigration.
Sure.
And so two problems there. When we are immigrating to other countries, we are not at all prepared to do that. Mm. That's one problem. Then the second problem is when we settle down in a country, we are not prepared for the coming years, the coming yeah. generations. So
right.
this model has to be sorted out. And if this model is created for the whole globe, I think we will have a better, happier in human community all over the globe. Otherwise, this will just keep on continuing is what I believe.
One thing that makes people happy, of course, are some of the cultural anchors that they carry with them. And I'm curious, what so far has been, you know, your favorite, perhaps, cultural anchor, whether that be festival or food or some activity? What's been, you know, something that's been a favorite anchor for the experience in Japan so far? Maybe one favorite that has brought you joy.
I always answer it to be people. It's yeah. all about people. And then all other rest of the things. Because as a community, we are people. Be it the right. social community around your house, be it your school, the students and the teachers will be your community, be it your office. People are the central part of your life. And if you are good with the people, then everything is fine. So people are your supporters and people are your barriers. So they will work both ways. And what I have found is I really found a few good people in Japan who have actually supported me, who have been around me, and maybe because of them, I have chosen to be here for a longer time.
Yeah. So they've become your family, your community, you sort of an extended support network.
Exactly.
In a way, all of this still is about cultivating trust. It's reducing barriers and finding ways to coexist and collaborate, whether that's finding a way to be Indian in Japan or finding a way to bring more Indianness, so to speak, to the Japanese society. What's been maybe the biggest accelerator of cultivating trust for you so far? Both in on both sides of that, right? In endearing yourself further to the Japanese society, and for you to, for that matter, feel that much more at home as an Indian in Japan, do those accelerators of trust, in fact, not only keep you there, but do they also motivate you to continue to bring change?
I feel that the one of the key things would be finding the mean. When we talk about, say, diversity or inclusion, it's all about the differences between the people. Even in a family, everybody is so different. But why right. family stays together is because we find the mean, the middle right. way between all of us. Similar way, like if I have immigrated to Japan, so I have tried to find the mean. May not be the best mean yet, but I have tried to learn a few things from the Japanese.
Right.
Like I said, I have imitated a few things. And on the other side, what I have tried to do is I have tried to compassionately communicate. So take and give is what I have been trying to do. Within that, the steps have been first take and then give. If you come over to a new country and then you just start giving from the first day, giving your knowledge, your ideas, your knowledge, people won't like it. So when I give seminars in corporate world or to the freshers who will be joining maybe conglomerates, kind of international companies, I tell them, first go into the system, watch the system for 3 months, 6 months, maybe a year. Understand the system, how it works, where the problems are, why those problems are, and then start talking about it. So first take,
of course,
and then give.
Well, certainly finding the mean, understanding how to give and take and doing it in a very thoughtful way. Hopefully more than anything else, it's translating to finding home and also finding a lot of success Yogi, thank you so much for such a wonderful conversation. And we really wish you all the best as you go forward.
Thank you so much, Dr. Abhay, and it was really fun talking to you.
Thank you so much again, Yogi. And to everyone listening, wherever home is for you, I hope you're enjoying these episodes and finding your community. Till next time, I'm Abhay Dandekar.